On behalf of the World Affairs Council of Northern California, I would like to welcome you to tonight's program, America's Growing Inequality. We are pleased and honored to have with us Nobel laureate Joseph Stiglitz. My name is Camille Guimaras, and I am the Membership and Annual Fund Officer for the World Affairs Council. I would like to take a moment to thank our members for supporting the Council and also to welcome any new members here tonight. Our members provide a foundation for the work that we do, and we cannot thank you enough for continuing to invest in the World Affairs Council. If you're here as a guest, I hope you will consider becoming a member in the future to take advantage of exclusive opportunities such as tonight's program. I would also like to thank the Marines Memorial Club for hosting this event. This evening's program is being recorded for radio, and we thank our audio engineer, David Ogilvy. The program is also being webcast on our live stream channel, and I would like to welcome our web audience. I would now like to introduce this evening's moderator. Terry Kramer is an entrepreneur in residence at Harvard Business School and a trustee of the council. He was formerly a regional president of Vodafone Americas and sat on the board of Verizon Wireless. He holds an MBA from Harvard Business School and a BA from UCLA. Please join me in welcoming Terry Kramer, who will introduce tonight's speaker.
Good evening and welcome. I'm Terry Kramer, a member of the trustees here at the World Affairs Council, and also will be the moderator this evening. It's now my distinct pleasure to introduce our guest for this evening, our speaker. Joe Stiglitz is a university professor at Columbia University in New York and co-chair of the university's Committee on Global Thought. Dr. Stiglitz served in the Clinton administration as a member of the Council of Economic Advisors, and for 2 years, he was their chair. Between 1997 and 2000, he served as chief economist and senior vice president of the World Bank. His many awards include the Nobel Prize in Economics in 2001, and had a shared also Nobel Peace Prize in 2007. He's the author of many books, and his newest one will be the topic of discussion tonight, The Price of Inequality. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Joe Stiglitz. So, Professor Stiglitz, let me start out by, for the benefit of the audience, getting a better sense of some of the key messages in your book. And one of the things that struck me as I read the book are some of the dire consequences you identify as a result of the inequality we have. Dire consequences including people questioning our democracy, questioning the growth that we're going to experience as a nation, market inefficiencies that are created, and most importantly, an environment that's worse for everybody, for the wealthy as well as everybody else. Tell us a little bit about your messages there and how did we get into the problem we're into now?
Well, maybe I should begin in the beginning, not in the beginning, but begin with what I talk about in the first part of the book, is trying to describe the magnitude of the inequality in the United States. I don't think most Americans really realize how far we've come. Watching inequality grow is sometimes said like watching the grass grow. You can't see it day to day, but after a while, you can't ignore it. So today, the United States is the most unequal of any of the advanced industrial countries. And it was that way, you know, say 10, 15 years ago, but we continue to increase our inequality, so the gap with the rest has increased. I think the other fact that I think that is so disturbing is that our image of ourselves is that we are a land of opportunity, you know, rags to riches. And we all know stories of people, or even know people, who made it from the bottom to the top, immigrants who came here and succeeded. But from an economist's perspective, what matters are not those stories, but what are the life chances? What is the likelihood of somebody from the bottom making it to the middle, from the middle making it to the top, you know, what we call the social degree of social mobility. And the United States is the least, the country with the least equality of opportunity, again, of any of the advanced industrial countries for which it's data. Very contrary to our image of ourselves. We used to think of old Europe as ossified and our society as dynamic and mobile. Not true anymore. After World War II, they realized their problems and they worked to create more opportunity. And meanwhile, what happened in the United States, we went the other way. The consequences of this, as you say, are manifest in every dimension of our society. I spent a lot of time talking, you know, because I'm an economist, talking about the economic consequences. Not an accident that in the years right before the Great Depression, inequality reached a peak, just like it soared in the years before the Great Recession. Systematic evidence that more inequality is associated with more instability. And it's not just me, it's something the IMF, which is not known as a very far left organization, has come to the conclusion. The UN Commission investigating the sources of the crisis, all have identified growing inequality as a source. If we have time, I can try to explain the mechanism. But more generally, economies with more inequality don't do as well. And we can see that back home in the United States, in the period after World War II, we grew much more rapidly than we did since 1980. The period since 1980 has been marked by much higher levels of inequality. And interestingly, in the period that in the decades after World War II, we grew together. So everybody grew, but those at the bottom grew more rapidly. So the divergences were narrowed. Since 1980, those have increased. In fact, and this is another important point I try to make in the book, which is there is a view, particularly on the right, that this is the politics of envy. You know, don't be envious. Everybody benefits from this inequality. It's called trickle-down economics. You throw enough money at the top, everybody benefits. The evidence is to the contrary, that while the top has done extraordinarily well in the last 30 years, their share of the GDP has doubled. The top 1% share has doubled. Most Americans today are actually worse off than they were, say, a decade and a half ago. Median income of those in the middle, is actually lower today than it was in 1997. And the numbers that just came out today from the Federal Reserve show that in terms of wealth, things are even worse. That this has been compounded, obviously, by the housing bubble breaking. But what we've done is been to, for most Americans, wiped out all the savings, increase in their wealth, over the last couple of decades. So the picture is not a pretty one. The other corollary, the other implication of this fact that inequality is bad for growth is that it contradicts one of the basic propositions of the right. Right says, oh, okay, we can understand your concern about inequality, but the price of doing anything about it, the cost of doing anything about it, is too great. If we try to bring down the inequality, the consequence would be that we would all suffer. What I try to argue here is, again, it's just the opposite, that we're paying a very high price for this inequality, and that if we took actions that I describe at the last chapter of the book that would bring down inequality, we would actually have a more dynamic economy. We would actually grow faster. So we're paying a very big price for this inequality.
Mm-hmm. Very helpful depiction here. So obviously the situation is severe. Who are the culprits in this situation? Should our elected leaders have been doing more? Is it the business community and business leaders? Is it society? You make some reference to changing values in the American society. Where does the problem lie?
Well, some people put the onus on market forces. Market forces do play a role, but the important thing to realize is the market forces are global. They're affecting every one of the other advanced industrial countries. We're unique. We've shaped those market forces to have the highest level of inequality. So the point is that market forces don't exist in a vacuum. We pass laws and regulations that affect how those get shaped. And we've shaped them in ways that help the top and which hurt the rest. Well, let me try to illustrate with a couple examples. One of them is, look at the bankruptcy law. The U.S. bankruptcy law says that derivatives, those risky products that brought AIG down, you know, that U.S. taxpayers had to bail out with $150 billion of corporate welfare, more money than we paid for all the poor people over many, many years. Well, those derivatives were given priority in bankruptcy. That means if their company goes bankrupt, the derivatives get paid before workers or before anybody else. Meanwhile, student loans are not dischargeable in bankruptcy, no matter what the, whether the school doesn't live up to its promises, the individual doesn't get a job. You know, normally we say when somebody sells a product, you say satisfaction guaranteed or your money back. And with our for-profit schools, these are mostly for-profit schools, they say satisfaction almost guaranteed not to occur and you'll never get your money back. It's going to be an albatross around your neck. And part of the problem here is the financial sector, which makes a lot of money off of these student loans. And that's the other example. We have a legal framework that encourages the banks to engage in speculation, non-transparent activities, predatory lending, abusive credit card practices. That's just to begin. But not to do the basic things that they're supposed to do. You know, financial sectors are very important. The problem is our financial sector hasn't been doing what it's supposed to be doing. And again, it's the laws and regulations that allow them to do it. And when you have results like this, it distorts the economy, and that's why our economies like this don't do as well as economies that don't have these kinds of problems. But at the same time, if you have predatory lending, what you're doing is moving money from the bottom to the top. And that's not creating wealth, that's just moving money around.
Makes sense. Interesting. Let me delve into a couple areas you cite in the book on the political and economic system. And you talk about our political system evolving to a $1, one vote mentality. Not one person, one vote, but $1, one vote. And you make an interesting comment regarding the likelihood of individuals succeeding being based more on their parents' income, their income and their education, than it is by the true merit and the opportunity that exists in society. Tell us about both of those.
Well, the first problem is it was in a way motivated by a puzzle that arises in political science and political analysis. In a democracy, the presumption is that the decisions will reflect where most of the citizens are. And so it ought to reflect the middle. And there's a well-developed theory called the median voter, that the person in the middle is the one that should be shaping the policies. If you look at what happens in the United States, you can't in any way say that that describes political process. Most Americans did not think that the bailout of the banks was a good thing. 75% of them thought we needed stronger banking regulation. If you go through a lot of the policies, it's very clear they're not in the interest of the majority of American citizens. I mean, obviously, you would not have an economic system in which most citizens are worse off today than they were 15 years ago. It doesn't. So the question is, how do you explain that? And just like I was mentioning before, just like rules and regulations shape the economy, the way we set our political rules shapes our political system. So if you have the role of the lobbyists, the role of campaign contributions, role of revolving doors, and then you have rules, you have decisions like Citizens United, which make it even more easy for the wealthy, for corporations to exert their political influence. You have other decisions I talk about in the book, like one of the decisions where one of the states tried to level the playing field to try to, and the Supreme Court ruled it down. So, and then you have gerrymandering. You have a whole set of actions which are designed to disempower, disenfranchise, and in the end, disillusion a large number of voters. Reflected in the fact in the 2010 election, 80% of the young people decided that it wasn't worth going to the polls. 80% in our democracy. And the reason they came to that view was they felt whoever we vote for is going to be the moneyed interests that are going to determine the outcome. And what I try to describe in the book is how this gives rise to a vicious circle. Because people don't vote, it takes money to get the voters out. And that makes it money have more influence and gives more leeway to those moneyed interests. So they've created a dynamic which works for their benefit and against the rest. The other question you asked had to do with this system where the point that in America, a child's prospects, future income, is more dependent on the income and education of his parents than in any of the other advanced industrial countries. And that really is the way of articulating what we mean by there's less opportunity. And what that means is a two-way thing, that there's less prospect for moving up, but once you get to the top, there's less worry about going down. Some data that I cite in the book, that someone, a child of a well-off parent who does not so well in school would wind up with a higher income than a child of a less well-off parent who does well in school. So that more important than your performance is the connections and the other attributes of your parents. And that is really changing our conception of ourselves as a land of opportunity, a land of fairness.
So you've painted a picture, obviously, a pretty worrisome situation and one that's kind of challenging the democracy we have and the economic system we have. So then it kind of leads to the question, what do we do about this? Who are the people that own a solution here? Is it our elected leaders? Is it business? Is it somebody else? And what should they do to correct for this?
Well, there are actually many dimensions of America's inequality. We've been talking a lot about the extremes at the top, but there are also the problems at the bottom, that the proportion of the population in poverty has been increasing. And there's a problem of the hollowing out of the middle. The middle class isn't doing very well. Just as an anecdote, I was in India not that long ago, and over the front page, they had this article that pointed out that one out of seven Americans are on food stamps, and one out of seven Americans are facing food insecurity, which means they're going to bed hungry at least once a month, not because they're on a diet, but because they can't afford to buy food. And of course, the reason this got so much attention in India is there is a poor country where there is a real hunger problem, and you can understand it coming from the lack of income, you know, of the country. But the United States, there's no excuse for this. You know, there's no reason why there are these extremes of inequality. We don't have to have it, and as I point out, it's actually weakening our economy. Now, as you think about each of these parts of the inequality, you think about the various causes, and then you think about how to fix it. So one of the problems at the bottom, and it was brought out by the statistics that came out today from the Fed, one of the problems at the bottom is discrimination. That there's discrimination against all kinds of groups, blacks, Latinos, women, and that lowers their income, and that causes poverty. And the banks, I don't mean to beat up on the banks, but they really deserve it. the banks, a number of the leading banks in the United States, targeted financially unsophisticated. They actively engaged in discrimination. They used their toxic mortgages, their bad loans, and focused it on those who were various groups, Afro-Americans, Latinos. And you know, this is not just my saying this. They have had to pay multi-million dollar penalties in settlement of these charges. Well, as I mentioned, the people at the bottom and the middle have lost in this recession an enormous amount of wealth, but the losses of the Afro-American community and the Latinos was absolutely devastating because they were targeted by these bad loans. And so, you know, the people who were aspiring to join the middle class now really have had their dreams really dashed. So my, you know, message, who owns that part of the story? I think it's really important that those in the business community not stop this kind of discrimination, pay decent wages, and you know, deal with these longstanding problems. Much of what we need to do is going to have to be done by government. You know, that rewriting of the laws, regulations, stopping the corporate welfare, changing the tax laws, all of those are political decisions. But one won't get those political decisions unless you have active voters. Mm-hmm. And so in the end, it's going to have to be Americans, all Americans, realizing the difficulties that we've gotten ourselves in. I hope that people at the top will realize that it's in their enlightened self-interest to make sure that everybody partakes of the American dream. Mm-hmm. That and for their other 99%, I think that they have to understand that they've been sold a bill of goods, that the idea that what's good for the 1% is good for everybody is just wrong. Mm-hmm. And so if those two ideas got well understood, then I think we could get the political changes. You know, this has happened before. In the Gilded Age, our inequality reached new heights. Mm-hmm. And afterwards, we looked over the brink, and we said, you know, that we don't want to go there. And we pulled back from the brink, and we had the progressive era, antitrust laws, you know, and it worked. But then people forget, and inequality started to grow. We had the Roaring Twenties. And after that period, we again pulled back, we re-examined, and we had an era of very good social legislation, the Wagner Act, laws, working conditions, Social Security, really important pieces of legislation that, you know, for instance, Social Security has virtually eliminated poverty among the elderly. And it really worked. We're now at another juncture like that. Hopefully, looking at those historical examples, we'll realize that there is an alternative to the way we're going.
Let me, again, delve into this further, though, because you talk about political action, but in the book you seem to imply that most Americans do not believe the inequality issue is that significant, that there's a problem, but it isn't that significant, and where people do feel there's some sort of issue, they feel the government can't take action here. So how do you get that political action if the electorate doesn't have a sense of urgency around this?
Well, that was why I wrote this book. And so the appropriate answer is for you not only to buy the book, but to send to all your friends. but the point that you make is really an important one, and I give some data in the book. Most Americans do not realize the degree of inequality that we have. And what's so striking is that, you know, there's some work in psychology and political science where people have asked Americans, what do you think is a good distribution of income? You know, look at a pie chart. And they understand that you need some degree of inequality. You have to have incentives that nobody wants a zero degree of inequality. But when they look at that, they look at these pie charts and they say, they pick out a particular one. It turns out to be Sweden, the country with a great deal of equality, and economy, by the way, that's working quite well. On the other hand, they don't think, you know, when we look at the pie chart of the United States, they say this is not something that's good, but they don't realize it's the United States. You know, they make these choices without the label, and so in a sense, they don't understand where we've gotten. I think once they understand where we've gotten, once they understand that we are no longer this land of opportunity, I think views will begin to shift.
So you're somewhat optimistic that things will get better.
Somewhat optimistic.
That's the operative word.
I end the book with this, you know, is there hope? And as I mentioned, there have been these periods in the past where we pull back from the brink. I look around at other countries. Brazil, for instance, is a country that had a high level of inequality, one of the highest in the world. People had to live in gated communities, a lot of political, social, economic turmoil, tensions. And then about 20 years ago, they said, this is not the direction we want to go. If we continue to go this way, our whole society is going to end in a complete mess. And there was a social consensus all the way from the top 1% on down, that we have to begin dealing with the problem. You had Cardoza, used to teach at Berkeley, and President Cardoza, who center-right, but really committed to making sure that everybody, no matter what their parents were, got a good education. You know, he was starting way behind, and I don't, you know, they didn't get all the way, but really pushed the agenda. And then President Lula, slightly left of center, said, inexcusable, even though there are not a rich country like the United States, a middle-income country, inexcusable that children should go to bed hungry, that they shouldn't have basic health care, and started a whole set of programs to make sure something was done about this poverty, particularly focusing on children. What's so interesting, in a space of less than two decades, you see the results in the macroeconomic data. You see the results in the measure of inequality. And so it's worked. And so the same global forces that are leading to more inequality in the United States, they've tamed those, and they're reducing the degree of inequality. They still have a lot of inequality, but they're at least moving in the right direction. And that gives me hope that the United States will see where we're going, and we too could move in that other direction.
Okay. And let me start weaving in some of the questions from the audience here, because on the last point you made, there's a variety of questions about where is a role model in this. And the question, you know, comes up about Europe. In many cases, some of the things that you're advocating, curbs on executive compensation, affordable health care, a more progressive tax rate, are all things Europe has deployed. But obviously now they've got, you know, notable economic and political challenges. So is Europe a role model as well? Or you say, listen, I've seen some things here that suggest this isn't necessarily the right path.
Well, first, you know, Europe's problem come from one big mistake, and that was the euro. And when the euro was created, most economists, most American economists, were skeptical. One of my colleagues at Columbia got a Nobel Prize for the work that he did on what's called the optimal currency area. When can you bring a group of countries together and share a currency? It's not easy, because when you share a currency, you take away the exchange rate, the interest rate mechanism for adjustment. When you have a shock, much more difficult to adjust. It was a political initiative, not an economic initiative. But the politics wasn't strong enough to really complete the project to create the institutions that would make it work. And a lot of economists said, you know, this is a flawed institutional structure. And the politicians in Europe came back and said, don't worry, this is just the beginning. We're going to bring Europe closer together. And over time, we will fix the mistake. The problem is, when things were going well, nobody was interested. And I was hoping that in January 2010, when the Greek crisis broke out, they would understand what I've just said, and Germany and the other countries would finish the project, create a solidarity fund for stabilization, realize that you can't have a banking system that is backed by each single country, because when the country is having a problem, it can't bail out the banks, and the banks have been bailing out the country, and the country has been bailing out the bank. It's a bootstrap. Everybody sees through it, and it's just not working. So I was hoping that back in January 2010 that they would realize that, but they continually done the minimum amount to keep the system working, and usually the solutions work for a month, 2 months. The European Central Bank threw more than $1 trillion into the banking system just a few months ago, and they were all enthusiastic and say, oh, look at it, it's working. It lasted a couple months. But the point I want to make, and the point you raise is really important. It's not because of the welfare system, the European social model, the healthcare system. You know, in fact, Europe's healthcare system actually delivers better health at a fraction of the cost of America's healthcare system. If we had a healthcare system that was as efficient as Europe, we would have a healthier population and our budget deficit would actually disappear. There have actually been calculations showing that that if we could just get our healthcare costs into control in the way that it has happened in Europe, we would have actually, our budgetary situation would be basically solved. The countries in Europe that are doing the best right now are the countries of Scandinavia. Those countries have the strongest investments in people, in technology, in infrastructure, the strongest social safety net. They're having strong growth, but they're growing together, so the people in the middle are doing particularly well. And Sweden and Norway are not part of the euro, and so they haven't been dragged down by this flawed currency. But we shouldn't be mixing the problem of a flawed currency with the overall framework. To put it just one more little aspect of this, Merkel has repeatedly said one of the reasons that Germany has done so well is the European, German social model. That is to say, they have good social protection. One of the reasons why they've done so well is they protected workers in the Great Recession. And so the unemployment didn't soar, even though their exports really plummeted. So I think they would say, and I would agree, that actually that part of their system has been working well. It's just the currency that's the problem.
That's been the issue. So a follow-on question one of our members of the audience asked is, what will happen with the euro? What will happen with Greece and Spain? It's a new book, but we're going to ask you anyway.
Well, this is as much politics as economics. If they followed my economic advice, things would be a lot better. But that's not likely to happen. So I give it a 50-50 chance. The problem is that they are continually misdiagnosed the problem. And if you misdiagnose the problem, the prescriptions are going to be wrong. Let me give you an example. Back last December, they had another one of those agreements that didn't really solve their problem. They said, what we really need is to tie our hands and have more austerity. Well, that was a diagnosis based on looking at Greece and Greece's excess spending. But Spain, Ireland, had a surplus before the crisis. Spain and Ireland had a low debt-GDP ratio. So this pact that they made in December would not have prevented the current crisis and certainly won't solve the current crisis. The problems have to do with this institutional problem of the currency, the banking system, the fact that they need to stimulate growth and they haven't put together a framework that will do that. Let me make one other aspect about their debt. The debt GDP ratio of Europe is actually lower than that of the United States. But the problem is it's fragmented among all the different countries. If we didn't have a federal government, but California and New York all were separate, had to rely on their own, we would be in a mess too. We are in a mess, but we would be in a worse mess than we are now. Mm-hmm. So the point is it's this political problem, and they've gotten this halfway house where they brought the countries together halfway. I don't think it can work. They either have to bring them closer together or they're going to have to move further apart. And that's going to be a political decision that the leaders are going to have to face. And likely they're going to have to face it in the not too distant future.
Sense. The next set of questions, and we've got quite a few here, have to do with your recommendations that implicitly suggest there needs to be more investment in the economy. But in the current deficit situation that we have right now, what type of problems will we create further by more deficit spending, and should we have done more on the stimulus plan to begin with?
Well, first of all, let me try to frame the question of the deficit. If you were a business and somebody came along to you and said, I'll lend you money at zero interest rate, and you had some good investment projects that yielded returns of 15 or 20%, you'd be foolish not to do it. And that's really the position of the United States. We can borrow today, zero interest rate short, 1.5% long. And because we've underinvested for a very long time, we have a backlog of very high return investment projects in infrastructure, technology, education, lots of things that we could do. Nobody would look at a firm by just looking at one side of the balance sheet, the liability, without looking at the asset side. So if we take that money, yes, we borrow, but if you look at the balance sheet, the assets are going up. They will more than pay back the money. If you look at the medium term, our country's balance sheet will be improved. It's what we did after World War II. We forget, after World War II, we fought a war, we had a debt-GDP ratio that was, I think, over 130%. You know, as bad as Greece was at the beginning of this crisis. But we didn't flinch at that point. What did we do? We said, we have to have the GI Bill that will educate Americans. You know, we fought together, and we were going to make sure that those who had fought for the country got rewarded. But it wasn't just a humane policy. It was good economic policy. We were going through a transformation then of our economy from agriculture to an industrial economy. And that meant that you had to re-educate people. People who were good farmers are not going to be necessarily good in the industrial workforce. And that's what the GI Bill did. And so it was a stimulus package. It was an industrial policy. It was a policy that brought the country together and was one of the reasons why the years after World War II were years of fast economic growth and growth that brought us together. But we did that even though we had a very high debt-GDP ratio. So it was investment, and it was investment that paid off. It was also the period, if you remember, the National Highway Program. President Eisenhower, and this is bipartisan, by the way, interesting to note, President Eisenhower enacted the road, our national highway bill that provided the infrastructure. There's a very interesting book that Alex Fields, who teaches at Santa Clara, recently published about the Great Depression. And he said one of the things that happened in the Great Depression, we also invested in roads, and those investments in infrastructure increased the productivity in the private sector, and one of the reasons, again, that we did so well after World War II. Mm-hmm. So in my mind, it's really pound foolish to, penny wise and pound foolish to try to skimp now when we can borrow. We have to use our money wisely. I mean, absolutely, we have to use our money wisely. But to go into austerity, which is what a lot of people are arguing, would bring our economy down. We did that experiment under Herbert Hoover. And that converted the stock market crash into the Great Depression. Why anybody would want to do that again is a mystery. The IMF tried that experiment involuntarily in Korea, Thailand, Indonesia, Argentina, and each of those cases, economic theory proves right. It was a disaster. Europe has tried it in Greece, Spain, Latvia, Ireland, and each of those cases, austerity has brought on recessions or depressions. Mm-hmm. And why anybody wants to try it again, I don't know. But the evidence is so overwhelming that that's not going to work. Investments will provide the basis of our future growth and stimulate our economy today.
Mm-hmm. The next set of questions have to do with the effectiveness of the political right in the U.S. And matter of fact, you raise in your book that the political right, in essence, has been more effective at getting their message across and swaying people. A couple of questions here related to that. How do you explain the phenomenon of lower-income conservative voters consistently voting against their own economic self-interest? And the second one is, what is the number one best argument I can make to my Tea Party sister in Phoenix?
Well, that's a really hard, there are lots of arguments that you can make. The real question is, will she listen?
Right.
And that's the problem. Now, I spent a chapter puzzling about exactly the question that you raise. One aspect of it, I think, is the following. Corporate America has learned how to sell, how to market. And there's been a lot of interesting and quite good research in psychology in a field called behavioral economics. Some recent books have been written about this that explain how you can help shape people's perceptions. Example that's very dramatic is how the cigarette companies were able to persuade Americans that cigarettes were not dangerous, did not cause cancer. They said that they said, you know, there's no credible evidence that it caused cancer, even when in their very files they knew that they had the evidence, but they were extremely successful in marketing that idea. And so the if you can market toxic products like cigarettes, you can market toxic ideas. And I think they've done a pretty good job at that. They have the resources, they have the tools, and that's what I mean by modern marketing techniques, and they have the incentives to do it. They, in many cases, they control the media. There's just an article today about that in the paper. So the fact is that the consequence of all of this is that many people have been persuaded that what is in the interest of the 1% of the top is in their interest. And that's what I said, you know, it's clearly not true. Trickle-down economics doesn't work. It is not true that policies that would reduce our inequality would actually harm our economy. It's actually quite the contrary, that we can have more growth, a more dynamic economy, and more equality. And so trying to explain this, I think, and to try to explain the facts of where our country are is something that's really important. Let me just give you just one other example that, I mentioned in the book. Paul Ryan gave a speech where he said, well, all these people were talking about equality. We're not interested, you know, we're not socialists. We're not interested in equality of outcomes. We're interested in equality of opportunity. Well, that's true, but we don't have equality of opportunity. But the way he put it was to try to convince Americans that we do have equality of opportunity, you know, when we don't.
The next question has to do with the political landscape for solutions to occur. And this questioner says, a fiscally conservative or very conservative president, a Congress supported by Wall Street, a population that believes government is the problem, and I would just add the polarized environment in Congress today, et cetera, how do you envision getting a solution in that environment? This is getting very bearish, isn't it?
Yes. I guess if I were religious, I would say prayer. but I'm not. So that alternative is not really available to me. So as I say, it goes back to what I said before. Either we're going to have to convince the top 1% that it's not in their interest to continue in this divided society. We convince the 99% that they've been sold a bill of goods, that these policies are not in their interest. We have to persuade Americans that there is an alternative, and it's an alternative from which most of us will benefit. And as I say, as the data keeps coming in, you know, and as I say, the Federal Reserve report that came in just today, I hope it'll begin to sink on Americans that things really are different from what we think of things and as they've been. And it really is time to begin to address these problems.
Good, makes sense. This next questioner says, listen, let's assume that we actually aren't able to get some of the solutions near term, that the environment remains difficult. How far are we from the breaking point here? Maybe even talk a little bit about the Occupy movement and when do some of the protests become more violent and do we find ourselves in a spiral that's not in the right direction?
Well, first, I wanted to comment on the first part of your question. You know, what I try to lay out is a very comprehensive agenda, and there are lots of things in that agenda. And we don't have to do all of them, but there are many things that we can do that will improve things. And give a sense that there's some progress to dealing with it. Let me just give you one easy thing. A tax system that says that the upper one that has provisions that the upper 1% pays a tax rate of 15%. That's lower. That speculators are taxed at lower rates than those who work for a living. It's just wrong. And this is really the point. Not only is it wrong, it distorts our economy. If you tax speculators at a lower rate than people who work for a living, innovators who are inventing the transistor, you know, people who are really making a difference, then you're encouraging people to go into those kinds of activity, and that's distorting our economy and weakening our economy. And one of the things as a teacher that I've been very disturbed is how large a fraction of our best students went into finance. And, you know, our young people are our most valuable resource. And yet, we not only do we misallocate capital, we misallocated human capital. We misallocated our young people. And it's all understandable. When you have that much money going to speculation, to banking, and you don't pay the people who are the real innovators, the people who invent the transistor, discover DNA, you're going to get a distorted economy, and you're not going to get a productive economy. So that would be one thing that we could do easily, and in which there's very strong support. So, you know, corporate welfare is another. We give away a lot of money. We gave a lot of money to the banks. You look at the tax provisions, the special benefits to the oil companies. We overpay for drugs. One sentence in the Medicare Part D drug benefit was very important. But one sentence that said government, the largest buyer of drugs, can't bargain with the drug companies, is costing us taxpayers $500 billion over 10 years. Now, that's a giveaway. That money could have been used for investment, but instead, we're giving it away to the people at the top. When you give away our natural resources or sell them below market prices, again, it's creating wealth at the top, taking wealth away from the rest of us. So those are things I think that we can get a broad consensus on. You know, we may not be able to do everything, but at least some of these things I think are things that they can do.
And you believe that we're not really at a breaking point, which was the original...
let me say, what motivated Occupy Wall Street were three things, and I went last year around. I went to Egypt and talked to the young people in Tahrir Square, and I went to Tunisia. I went to Spain, met with the Indignados, and talked to them at Retiro Park. There's a common theme among all of these, which is one: markets were not working well, and that's pretty obvious when you have underutilized capacity and so many unmet needs. Something's not right. In Spain, they're in depression. You know, with one out of two young people unemployed, the system isn't working. Unemployment overall is close to 25%, which is reminiscent of our Great Depression. Clear, markets are not working. There was a hope, secondly, there was a hope that the politics would fix it. It didn't. In case of Dodd-Frank, we made moves in the right direction. But everybody realized that we didn't do anything about the too-big-to-fail banks. We really didn't do enough about the excessive risk-taking, as we saw in the J.P. Morgan case. We didn't do anything adequate about lack of transparency, the fact that nobody knows what will happen to our banking system if there's turmoil in Europe. So we really didn't fix our banking system. So they understand that politics hasn't really fixed our economic system. And thirdly, they realized that there's something really unfair about what's going on. So these three together are a common element in all these countries. In the dictatorships in Tunisia and in Egypt, you understood why politics didn't work. The real mystery is the United States and Spain and the other countries of democracies, why hasn't politics worked better? So what the protesters are saying, they want to get politics to start working. If politics responds, I think it will be another, you know, demonstration that democracy does work. If it doesn't, I think we are at risk of what's happening. You see it in Greece, growth of neo-fascist parties, growth of extremists. I think that's something that we should begin to worry about. So if we don't pay attention to the basic core message, then I think we ought to begin to worry.
You know, an element of what you're saying is the problem and the solution also seems values-oriented. You make reference in the book to a society that's become more self-serving in nature as opposed to being concerned about society. And certainly you look back in our own history to World War II and people gave their lives for the nation, they had to rebuild an economy, et cetera. What has happened that feeling of rallying behind a cause doesn't exist today in the same way?
Well, I think it's very understandable in the aftermath of World War II, the country fought together and fighting together brought the country together. And that really made people support these kinds of measures like the GI Bill that really provided for everybody who had fought certain basic education. Over the years, people forgot that kind of common struggle that the country had gone through. And so you got into these attitudes of me first, individualism. America has this history of individualism. And that sort of rose over the fact that we had been as a community fighting together and our survival had depended on it. But I think we may be entering another period that, you know, our society is becoming very divided. And if it goes in that direction, I think there are questions about whether at least the country as we knew it, as we conceive of it, will survive. And what are some of the basic values that we talk about? Among the basic values is equality of opportunity. You know, that, as I explained, my book is a myth. Take another basic principle, justice for all. Well, what did we see in the mortgage debacle? What we saw is people thrown out of their homes who didn't owe any money. That's not justice. You know, a system of justice is supposed to protect the weak. But what we did is the banks were allowed to throw people out of their homes. They signed affidavits saying they looked at the evidence, you know, at the records and the guy owned it. It was robo-signing. They hadn't done it. They were perjuring, in effect, to the court. Not one of these people has gone to prison. Not one of them has been held accountable. It's all in the vague thing of, oh, the corporation did it. The company did it. Well, there were individuals that were doing this. You know, corporations don't just act. There are individuals in the corporation. And if you don't have individual accountability, which is, again, one of the values, individual responsibility, then you're going to have these kinds of problems. So we've really made a mockery of our system of justice for all. And what we really have now, just like we've moved from one person, one vote, to something more akin to $1, one vote, rather than having justice for all, we are moving more to a system of justice for those who can afford it. These are really undermining our basic values.
So let me, in the last couple of minutes we have, let me ask you a concluding question here. You know, you've made a very compelling argument that the problem we have is significant, that we have the opportunity to lessen inequality, which would benefit everybody, but that we're at a juncture where there's a lot of political and economic challenges getting in the way of us solving this. Fast forward 5 or 10 years from now, what will the environment look like here? What will the U.S. look like? Will we have, you know, started to address this? Will the country be in a better place or not?
Well, again, that's a question I sort of talk about in the last chapter. And I think there are two alternative paths, and I really don't know which path we're going to go down. We could go down the path that is like so many of what I saw when I was chief economist of the World Bank, societies that are deeply divided. I remember going to one developing emerging market where not only were they living in a, you know, basically gated communities, the guy had to have his own movie theater because it was too dangerous for his kids to go out to any public place because they might be kidnapped. I went to another country where their children were living in Florida because it was too dangerous for them to live in their community. So, unless you've visited these countries and you see the kind what happens when you have a divided society, you know, the people at the top don't need public schools, public parks. They can afford to create those things themselves, but it's not a good environment. And I don't think they would want to that kind of society. So that's one direction that we could go. I hope it's not. The other direction, one I've described before, that we'll pull back from that, realize the direction that we've been going, realize that there is lots of things that we could do that would reduce this inequality and make our economy more efficient, more fair, more consistent with our values. I hope it's the alternative one that we choose.
Good. Let's hope the latter scenario is the one that that happens. Let me just say on behalf of the World Affairs Council, a special thank you to Joe Stiglitz for a fascinating and timely discussion. Thank you. Thank you to all of you for... Thank you to all of you for a great set of questions. And Joe's going to be staying here to sign copies of his book, Price of Inequality. Thanks again.